Les colloques du Collège de France.
Nous sommes très contents d'accueillir, très heureux d'accueillir Stéphanie Ganger, qui est professeure d'histoire moderne à l'université d'Heidelberg, bien connue pour ses travaux d'histoire globale des savoirs et des sciences. Elle a d'abord travaillé sur les collections d'antiquités américaines, notamment dans son premier livre, Relics of the Past, The Collecting and Study of Pre-Columbian Antiquities in Peru and Chile, qui est paru en 2014. Et je vous signale sur le même thème en français, un très bel article publié avec Miruna Hashim en 2021 dans les annales, pas encore classique, c'est le titre, La fabrique des antiquités américaines au XIXe siècle. Puis en 2020, Stéphanie a publié A Singular Remedy, qui est un essai sur le quinquennat et sur l'histoire du succès planétaire de cette plante d'Amérique du Sud au début du XIXe siècle. Actuellement, elle travaille sur l'histoire des fièvres et son exposé porte précisément le titre suivant, The Wisest Man Nevertheless Knows the Nature of a Fever, Epistemic Geographies and Enlightenment Disputes. The floor is yours.
Je vous remercie très sincèrement pour cette invitation ainsi que pour cette aimable présentation. C'est pour moi un grand plaisir d'être parmi vous aujourd'hui. Je vous prie d'excuser que je m'exprime en anglais si après, toutefois, n'hésitez pas à poser vos questions après en français. So in the following, what I'm going to do, I'm going to present a piece that is part of a book manuscript, as Antoine already said, on the history of fever or fevers in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, mainly across the Western European territories and empires. And what I'll talk about now is a first iteration of chapter one, which is the most conceptual in nature. If there was one subject that medical writers of the late 1700s and early 1800s were agreed upon, it was how little they knew of the nature of fever. One would think that since there was no distemper so common, few so fatal in all ages and all countries, and since fevers had employed the pens of the most enlightened of the profession for the space of 2,000 years, there would be none with the nature of which we ought to be better acquainted, as John Curry wrote in 1774. And yet, fever was much less known and had been more the subject of dispute than any other disorder, though not as any organ, as we've already heard. Indeed, while no physician could be at a loss to recognize a fever, none had yet been able to define it, as the Spanish medical author Andrés Piqueria Rufat put it in 1788. They neither agreed among themselves as to what fever is or in what it essentially consists, nor have they assigned to it any certain and determinate seat. The ailments included in that wide category, its internal division, genera, taxonomy, everything was elusive, controversial. As George Ford has put it, neither its causes, rise, progress, termination are thoroughly known. Or as one doctoral student in Buenos Aires wrote, there are few terms, the meaning of which is as vague as that of fever. There is no subject in the whole range of medicine on which our ideas are more unsettled than that of fever. It had become almost a proverb, as anyone could have read in Hermann Burhaver's classic aphorisms, that the wisest man nevertheless knows not the nature of a fever, or as the Encyclopédie put it, the enlightened physician was still searching for the nature of fever, only the ignorant one, always presumptuous, could flatter himself to have seized it. My paper today examines these debates over the nature of fever, its place in the taxonomic order, seat in the body, among medical authors writing from across the British, Iberian, and French empires, whether it's Dublin or Luanda or Pont-au-Prince in the late 1700s and early 1800s. And my main purpose will be to explain, as in to make sense of, the untiring insistence of the period's medical writers on that elusiveness, the peculiar elusiveness and obscurity of fevers. I'm interested in why they were so very much at a loss, so doubtful, for it to become almost a topos or kind of a truism and a commonplace in that period. And I'll argue that there are obviously a number of reasons situated at different epistemological levels and sort of ways of levels of generality, you could say, that account for this together. One is certainly the nature of that concept, that very amorphous and broad concept, fever. Epidemiology, the geography of fevers in that period, also the period's epistemic virtues will come into this skepticism. We've already seen that you can find this discourse in relation to other objects as well, a penchant for dissent, and not least empiricism, which made physicians and medical authors in the metropoles reliant on men on the ground, especially in this particular case, Creole physician authors based in the torrid zone. And all of that together kind of allows me to sort of account for what you see here, and at the same time gives you a window into the period's debates about fever. So to start, one important factor to explain our author's sense that fever was an elusive condition, hard to pin down or conclusively define, lies in the scope and the width of that category and its peculiar form. The term fever would only acquire its modern meaning as symptom and quantifiable temperature from around the mid-1840s onwards. In the period that we are looking at, the term still meant a number of things. It referred to the companion of inflammation. It referred to a condition that attended other maladies, so symptomatic in a way, but most commonly it referred to a disease in its own right, or more precisely a class of diseases with dozens of kinds or species, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Most authors would also have agreed that fever was not reducible to heat. It was not even the principal symptom to a lot of them. Most importantly, it manifested in a range of sensations that some of them are not familiar with us, or familiar to us anymore, like a sort of a pulse that changes in a very particular way, a particular sense of weakness, and then either chills or heat, but also headaches, nausea, an altered state of mind, various kinds of difficulties breathing. So just one, I could have shown you a number of quotes. I went for Schiller. Although from the 1790s onward, developments in French clinical pathology and morbid anatomy came to try to locate fever in the body through characteristic organic lesions, many physicians in Britain and the Iberian countries especially continue to regard fever as a generic condition, a general disease, something that affects all of you. As Margaret Pelling has argued a long time ago, actually, by now, debates over the nature of fever were therefore inseparable from all these broader fundamental debates, systemic debates, essentially about disease and the body that were raging at the time. The explanation for fever for most of these authors had to be in terms of the systems that were capable of determining the whole state of the constitution. And that's one of the reasons why the simplest, but not an unimportant one, of why they are discussing so much and why there's so much controversy, because it's bound up with systemic debates. This is the Spanish physician Juan Jiménez y Forcá summarizing it, but again, it's just one voice among many, which basically juxtaposes all these different approaches. The resilient and indeed in that period resurgent Hippocratic-Hellenic model, which understands fever as heat, preternatural heat, the mechanical, iatromechanical models, Boerhaave and so on, to whom fever is essentially, the essence of fever is a too quick pulse, so it's all about circulation, which is too quick, accelerated. Heat is just a secondary effect, friction. And then you have the influential medical schools associated with William Cullen and his disciple John Brown, which relate fever to the nervous system. So it's all about stimuli and debility and so on, the vitalists, the moderns, etc. So essentially, debates about fever were controversial because in many places they were tied up with systemic controversies, but the peculiar elusiveness of fevers was also owing to the scope of that category. The period saw a baffling array of fevers, catarrhal fevers, quotidian tertian fevers, there were childbirth fevers, miliary fevers, jail fevers, and that's without even reckoning the so-called eruptive fevers, smallpox or measles, which were no longer classed with the fevers strictly so-called by many authors of the early 1800s. Not only had fever long been a wide disease category, our medical authors lived through an age of epidemiological upheaval in which they constantly encountered new fevers or unfamiliar fevers or newly virulent fevers, so fevers that had changed in their view. Typhus or continued fevers only gained currency as a diagnosis from the mid-1700s, but they were very important in the period that we're looking at, especially in the northwestern European sort of discourses in colder climates. Childbirth and scarlet fever, which had long been benign ailments sort of under the radar, and they suddenly become epidemic and manifest with graver symptoms in that period. A lot of women especially die in these cases. There's a new bilious yellow fever that's not actually new, but it breaks out of its usual torrid confines and suddenly strikes in western temperate climes in that period, Barcelona or Philadelphia. So basically, because theories of fever in that period are still derived from symptoms, And because symptoms change and vary and new symptoms get added, medical authors basically see the contours around the category that they're trying to define shift continually with each new or newly identified form. Fever is a moving target in a way in the period. Other than a rapidly changing epidemiological landscape, the period's epistemic virtues of empiricism, but also casuistry, specificity, because they're not really interested sometimes in abstraction, simplification, or generally you could say they're interested in specificity. And that means that they see a proliferation and a further accumulation of these categories in the period, and they see a combination of descriptives. So not only are there hundreds of fevers by the late 1700s, but you have fevers like the bilious remitting yellow fever, or the low irregular remittent fever, or the semi-tertian fever, so they constantly offer qualifications. José Pinto da Cerejo, who was Surgeon General of Portuguese Angola in the 1790s, he was originally Brazilian, he expressed it often more poignantly than others, fatigue and resignation over the multiplication of fevers, which render their study tedious, he says, nearly incomprehensible. Give them one additional symptoms and they'll come up with yet another species of fever. They'll call it icteroid and malignant and continuous, simple and bilious and so forth. But that proliferation, he says, is useless in practice and it serves only to, quote, foment doubts. Now, the period's prevailing conception of fevers as a fluid and a mutable condition. And again, you see a general zeitgeist in there that came up with the brain and with Ray's just in the other talks that we just heard, is not helping certainty either. So this is not about discrete ontological entities yet, but the way they understand fever is that different kinds or even species of fever might at any point merge into one another, or they might degenerate into more from one another, or they might morph, or they might complicate into one another. So the famine fevers that are prevalent in Ireland in that period, for instance, are owing to starvation and poverty and filth, but they could, in the eyes of contemporaries, evolve into contagious fevers at any time. Some intermittents might run up into an inflammatory fever, or might sink into low irregular remittance or slow or nervous fevers. According to Benjamin Rush, who is an American physician author and is very prominent at the time in fever writing, the yellow, inflammatory, and bilious remitting fevers that he observed in Philadelphia in the 80s and 90s were but transient states of one and the same fever, a fever that changed form continually, like a cloud on a windy day, as he writes. Fevers could also appear in disguise. There were tertian fevers disguised under the appearance of catarrhal fevers, as the Peruvian physician author José Hipólito Unanue cautioned his readership. Right, because you had to be careful, because it could change any time, then it would be more dangerous or less dangerous or whatever. Now, of course, with the rise of nosology from the 1730s, because we tend to associate that period with order, right? Foucault, a series of attempts were made to impose systematic order upon the growing number of fevers, to arrange them according to shared and distinguishing characteristics within the hierarchical tableaus and taxonomies in an order, as François Boissier de Sauvage put it, similar to that of the botanists. In many ways, however, these tiered hierarchies of taxonomic ranks that you find, Linnaeus's Genera Morborum or William Cullen's Synopsis Nosologiae Methodicae of 1769, added to the proliferation because they invited yet more subdivisions and more qualifications. And what is more, of course, this is a very distinctive understanding of order still, right? Critics, but also the very authors of these tableaus would always, or many of them would emphasize the fluidity of these tableaus or their provisional nature, or that, you know, that some fevers might actually move from one to the other. That's Cullen especially, who does it a lot. They would acknowledge that there were fevers that resisted qualification. That's another trope. Yes, you have a tableau, but there's this one that doesn't really fit. They would doubt very openly, actually, the usefulness of these systems still. They would stress their openness and they would stress their incompleteness. Like, I'm sure something's missing, right? And that's something that gets lost with sort of later modernity. And they would always question the necessity of taxonomic order. A lot of people would do that, which had just not as yet become self-evident. Now, another reason why our authors were so hesitant may well be owing to something that's palpable, what was palpable in the previous papers, but is very important here as well, is the period's epistemic virtues, which are kind of the background that informs all of this, of course. If we go back to the entry in Diderot's and D'Alembert's Encyclopédie, it's suggestive of a zeitgeist that many of the people in the room have written about, so I won't go into it all that much, of self-criticism, right? Of sort of critical, but self-critical in particular. Also, in some ways, sort of references possibly even to charlatanry, rejections of that, a culture of individualism, but also a culture of a skeptical tradition, essentially, that plays into this and is in the background to why they think that way, why they talk that way and argue that way. If you read it carefully, it doesn't just admit to physicians' uncertainty over the essence and nature of fever, but really it celebrates it. Certainty is the province of the ignorant. Historians have argued for some time now that the period's philosophe, but also its medical writers, regarded skepticism as an epistemic virtue, much like truth to nature or empiricism. The project of the Encyclopédie even was suffused with it, even though it's sort of it's a collection of all human knowledge, but it's also skeptical. Now, Enlightenment skepticism may have been especially conspicuous in contemporary writings on fever, I would argue, because of the preeminence within that corpus of Edinburgh-trained physicians, authors, and surgeons, because that's the other place in the European Republic of Letters where skepticism obviously plays an important role. And I do think that one important figure in that regard is William Cullen, whose nerve-centered theory of fever and whose taxonomic nosological scheme were hugely influential. Cullen appears to have been directly influenced by his friend David Hume, who was obviously one of the principal exponents of Enlightenment philosophical skepticism, and also other leading figures of the Scottish Enlightenment, as historians have argued. In particular, he seems to have absorbed a lot of their ideas concerning the limits of reason and the fallibility of the senses and human faculties and so on, but also a general rejection of dogmatism and metaphysical and other kinds of certainty. It's apparent if you go through his fever writings, a very careful emphasis on the contingency of nosological schemes, which are always heuristic rather than essentialist, caution regarding hypotheses, any definitive therapeutic instructions. He goes in circles all the time. And not least his insistence that the essence of fever remained unknown, hidden somewhere out there, but not known. Cullen taught medicine at Edinburgh from 1755 to 1789, and several of the period's foremost and most skeptical writers on fever studied there during his tenure. Henry Clutterbuck, George Fordes, José Pinto de Acevedo, and indeed Benjamin Rush, who would later write that it was at Edinburgh where he came to suspect, quote, error in everything I had been taught or believed, where he came to acquire his skepticism. Of course, Edinburgh was only one node, there were several, within a much wider network of skeptical medical thought that informed the intellectual landscape of the period as a whole. Nevertheless, it may help explain, at least in part, give context to the trope under discussions. More specifically, in spite of debates over its internal divisions, the disease category fever upheld its unity into the mid-1800s. And it is in this unity that we must, somewhat paradoxically, look for yet another reason for the divisiveness and the elusiveness of fevers, or fever. Medical writings on fever were conspicuously wide-ranging geographically in their citations and references. Again, not the only category, but conspicuously so. Even more so than with many other subjects in the period, they formed a conversation across among physicians spread out across our globe. That was, again, obviously the product of Enlightenment cosmopolitanism and of circumstance, also possibility, a nascent global public sphere in which medical writers on both sides of the Atlantic enjoyed access to newspapers and foreign publications and medical books and an expanding market to translations. And indeed, physician authors consulted, translated, responded to observations on fevers penned elsewhere all the time in a conversation that importantly did cut both ways in the sense that you have your Prussian fever treatises, which are adapted for a loser Brazilian audience, that's the example on the left, but also Northwestern periodicals that print translations of medical reports written by Spanish American Creole observers, for instance. And much of this reflects obviously, again, the period spirit of empiricism, its quest for direct first-hand experience of authentic testimonies. But this close conversation on fever was also the logical consequence of the fact that fever maintained its cohesion as a category before it would become, in the later 1800s, the symptom of many distinct disease entities. Because most of these authors remained persuaded that the childbed fevers that occurred in the Parisian maternity ward, or the West Indian fevers, or the remittent fevers of Angola, that they were all variants or transient states or subspecies, whatever, of one and the same disease altered by variables of geography, climate, circumstance, or constitution. So to understand and to finally know the nature of fever, it was necessary for them to engage in literary commerce, in conversations with people in different places. Henry Clutterbuck, for instance, who entered the, quote, field of speculation on the essence of fever, unquote, as he put it, in the early 1800s, cited disease histories from across the world in this endeavor, from this metropolis, which is London, of course, but also Batavia and the province of Bengal and Cadiz and Minorca and Philadelphia and Syria, because, he says, the manner of attack, the accompanying affections, the destructive nature of fever varied, and the careful observer had to see as much and as widely as possible to reveal the intimate nature of fever. So to do so, fever authors in the northwestern centers of medical writing relied heavily, of course, on their own well-traveled military surgeons. We've known that for some time, imperial correspondents for these case histories, but they also relied on medical observers born or resident in Spanish America, in British and Mughal India, in the West African factories, and the Iberian and Italian peninsulas and Corsica, because these were regarded as kind of middling or intermediate climates between temperate and tropical ones. They could also offer important observations. This wide view added species and symptoms and hence complications, but also, and more importantly, it added critics. Some correspondents from the colonies wrote to confirm the system prepared in the metropole, but, and that's the important point, the majority disagreed and wrote to critique it. And they did so often in a very destructive, acerbic manner, even more destructive than these people are with one another very often. Many used evidence gained on the basis of their experience with fevers on the ground, and that's the main discourse, to argue against the prevailing taxonomic order or therapeutic instructions for febrifuges, whatever. For instance, diluted nitric acid might do nothing for Prussian sufferers, but it worked wonders in the humid climate of Bahia, as Enriquez de Paiva argues, or as the Creole naturalist José María Mocinho upheld. His experience with West Indian yellow fever suggested that it was erroneous to class the Andalusian fever with typhus fevers, as everyone did. They were intermittent, and they were distinguished with an epithet which was pernicious, and so on. Right? We don't have to go into the detail, but it's constantly no. Others questioned the very grounds of fever theory. José Pinto de Acevedo, again, who was premising his own authority on both his erudition, the fact that he'd been trained in Edinburgh, and his experiences with fevers from Pernambuco to Luanda, not only questioned the sense and usefulness of nosological subdivisions, but also the theory of critical days in fevered complete error in his eyes, and more broadly, all, quote, opinions on the nature and course of fever that had come out of the metropoles. The humoral accounts from Galen to Sydenham to Boerhaave, he sensed, were totally discredited. The more recent theory of Brown, a, quote, mere daughter of the imagination, its insufficiency evident in practice. He was hesitant even about his teacher Cullen's nervous theories, though it was closest to the truth. A mai chegada verdade, he writes. So all of these writers adopt a similar classic man-on-the-ground kind of posture. Their arguments are not the offspring of a fertile imagination or a good library or ancient doctrine, but it's observation, experience, arduous, long service in climates where this stuff actually occurs, whether it is India or Jamaica or Cadiz. And they would use their position to out-argue those who have never seen the disease or been in climates where it prevails, and they would dismiss their, quote, absurdities, their, quote, metaphysical subtleties, their unintelligible nonsense. Our historic subjects sense that their experience and observations were more accurate, that they exposed the limitations of established systems and theories may well have been genuine, some extent. But it was also, as historians have long argued, a rhetorical device and an epistemic posture that they adopted. Most of the men born or long resident in hot and middle climes were pushing into the system from the margins. So they were lowly surgeons seeking to raise their fortunes, or they were Scottish-born dissenters barred from the inner circles of British medical power, or indeed Spanish and Portuguese-American Creole authors who were just at that time seeking to carve out a role and a space for themselves within the period's transatlantic republic of letters. As various historians have argued, Creole experts on the natural world was not never really, or at least not in that period, straightforwardly excluded or silenced. It's not as simple as that. But they came to understand their particular privilege and niche and province within the period's epistemic geography as lying in their proximity with American nature and indigeneity, and is being able to mediate between that and those in the metropoles. And they were all the more necessary. Their authority was enhanced all the more by the inscrutability or the distance or indeed the resistance to theory that their objects of study offered. There are actually quite a few cases in which that strategy succeeded, where descent afforded them distinction or visibility, in some cases even status or an office, as with Jean de Vez or José María Mocinho, whom I've just shown, who all secured positions in Philadelphia and in Cádiz, in these cases fighting yellow fever when it came from the tropics there. It also provided a means of compensating, of course, for things they did not have, like their limited access to the news publications or more prestigious institutions and so on. Whatever their reasons, many of these authors were clearly bent on critique and qualification and complication, and certainly not consensus. Of course, they operated within an academic climate that was generally harsher and more acerbic, a wider culture of dissent and individualism to which national rivalries added sort of force in that period. As one contemporary put it, there were not 10 men in Great Britain who absolutely agreed in the most essential points relating to fevers. And yet, this wider imperial landscape surely did little to foster certainty. These writers from the margins would not only have argued readily that existing theories of fever were flawed and misguided, they would also have deepened the sense of uncertainty among authors in the metropole who depended, indeed had no choice but to depend among them. Even the wisest man, nevertheless, knew not the nature of a fever because fully understanding it required the broadest possible vision, field of vision and an understanding of fevers across distant regions and oceans alike. And it was precisely there in those imperial spaces that one encountered some of the strongest resistance. Now, to conclude, these debates offer a window into the period's understanding and conception of fever, the epistemic virtues, the moral economy of science that marked it, and not least the warp and weft of its geographically expansive medical republic of letters. They allow us to make sense of why the period's physician authors felt they could not know the nature of a fever, grasp its inner order or seat or form. The causes and conditions that explain the pervasiveness of our trope, different kinds, some are conceptual, others cultural, again others epidemiological, but all taken together, they sort of yield an edifice. The elusiveness of fever was due to that concept's shifting amorphous form, its width, its being tied up with systemic controversies over the nature of the body. It certainly was also a posture, part of a general culture of skepticism and dissent and empiricism over doctrine that was particularly prevalent in the fever literature, partly in due to close ties with strands of Scottish and French Enlightenment thought, but also the, again, systemic persuasion that to understand the true nature of fever, physician authors had to cast a wide net to consult those familiar with its torrid manifestations who were in turn bent on qualification and complication rather than consensus for reasons of both epidemiology and epistemic geography. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.